Savsai in Pakistan 2 years ago had been arrested. The equal rights campaigner, who was 14 at the time, was targeted by the Taliban, who have already claimed responsibility. The Chancellor and Governor of the Bank of England have cancelled plans to be in Australia next week in case Scotland votes yes to independence. The latest poll released earlier gives a tiny advantage to the No campaign. And Nicole Kidman is said to be in shock tonight following the death of her father. The actress's publicist has released a statement asking people to give her time to deal with the tragedy. Her father was a distinguished psychologist. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
I just want to get funky.
BCFM 93.2 plays more Bristol music than any other station. Bristol's first.
My house in Budapest, my hidden treasure chest. Golden grand piano, my beauty focus.
Love Bristol.
Love
BCMM.
Don't call it a love song. Don't call it a love. Don't call it a love song.
From New York to Bristol.
You can count on us to put Bristol music first.
My heart beats in the rhythm out of that eastern sea. But in the city you see when they tell you done.
Love
BCFM. Love is all I ever want. Love is all I ever need.
Made in Bristol, this is your award-winning BCFM.
BCFM
on 93.2,
24 hours a day.
Bristol kind of love, it sure is. It's Billy Quain sitting in for Tony Gosling on the Friday Politics. And because by this time next week, we will know whether or not it is bye-bye baby to Scotland. Here's Tony Gosling's favourite, the Bay City Rollers.
If you hate me after all I say,
can't put it off.
Just gotta tell her anyway.
Bye, baby.
You're the one girl in town I'd marry.
takes me back to when I was but a pup. Bay City Rollers, Bye Bye Baby. You're listening to The Politics Show here on a Friday evening on Bristol Community 93.2 FM. My name is Billy Quain, sitting in this week for Tony Gosling, who's on his hollyhocks. If you'd like to contact us this evening, and I would encourage you to do so, we're in the studio live until 7 p.m. You can pick up the phone and dial 955-3721 to get us in person. Send us a text message, I particularly like those, to 60777, and please start your text with BCFM. Or alternatively, you can drop me an email, studio@bcfmradio.com. Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, you have got something hot off the press for us.
Yes, well, last week, Billy, as I mentioned, and those who are regular listeners to the show will know, I got some inside information that Dr. Stephen Davis, who's essentially the Archbishop of Canterbury's representative in Nigeria, was going to accuse various politicians in northern Nigeria of being in bed with Boko Haram, the terrorist group, so-called, which have kidnapped these girls. And the names of the politicians were Ali Modu Sharif, Lamido Sanusi, who's from the Central Bank, Atiku Abubakar, and General Babangida. And he was pointing the finger particularly at the what's called the All Progressives Congress, the APC, which is a Muslim-based northern Nigerian political party.
Okay, I had been expecting to hear more about this in the mainstream media.
No, in actual fact, this has come out in the media in Nigeria.
Okay.
So the leading newspaper in Nigeria called Leadership, which came out on the 11th of September this week, Lai Muhammad is one of their leaders. Said that Dr. Stephen Davis had accused his party of being in bed with Boko Haram. He was denying it. He was saying that certain elements within the PDP government were in bed with Boko Haram, including General Ihejirika. But anyway, these names are the only person I've actually heard of in all of this is Babangida, former head of state. But anyway, so both the Northern Nigerian Islamist parties and the Southern Nigerian PDP, which is run by Goodluck Jonathan, who's the current president, are accusing each other of being in bed with Boko Haram and of turning a blind eye to it, and or of being incompetent in dealing with the consequences of their insurgency. So this story has been broken in Nigeria this week. I understand it will come out in the British media in the next week or so.
Okay, so why are we discussing it? Thumbs are in this pie?
Well, what I am getting inside information from places I cannot divulge.
Obviously, about a source.
And the point is that this politics show has an international following, Billy, on the internet, and therefore those concerned wanted it to be broken here first. So we got first bite of that cherry. Now I spoke with my source earlier, and who told me that it had been broken in Nigeria. And sent me some material that showed that it had been broken in Nigeria. So we can confirm that this story has been broken, and now the politicians in Nigeria are all accusing each other of being in the pockets with Boko Haram or incompetent in dealing with it and so on. But the other tidbit that I was given was that there has been a meeting in Saudi Arabia between the leaders of Boko Haram, the leaders of Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and the leaders of Al-Qaeda, whatever that means, and that they are coordinating their strategy. But this is the same week that John Kerry
was
in Saudi Arabia coordinating his strategy with the Saudis for how they're going to support supposedly moderate rebel factions within Syria.
Is support by which you mean give loads of guns to
yes.
at Britain and America's expense?
Yes, basically. The whole situation in the Middle East, as people will be aware, is very fraught. And we're now seeing the potential for big power conflict around it, because, of course, the two sides are shaping up. It's NATO plus its Gulf allies versus Syria, Iran, and Russia and its allies.
OK, so when you say NATO here, the North Atlantic treaty organization. Thank you. We're looking here at old colonial countries and the US with a vested interest in some of these countries. Saber-rattling from Britain, France, not Germany so much, because they don't really like to get their hands dirty with this sort of thing. Italy and possibly Spain. Who else? Who am I missing here?
Well, Italy and Spain, I mean, the way NATO works is it's definitely a hierarchical structure with the US at the top, but Britain is definitely
a
lapdog of the Americans and therefore what junior officers, if you like, within the coalition. They've also got a track record going back a long way of dealing with these so-called jihadi groups. It's like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which you mentioned last week.
Mm-hmm. And the Mujahideen.
And the Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda itself, which was, as Robin Cook famously said, simply means the database of all the chaps that we trained and sent into Afghanistan, which was held originally in Amman in Jordan. And that's where the name comes from. And all of these people had been through the hands of the Western Intelligence Services and Special Forces. We're supposed to believe that these groups, having been trained and directed by Western Intelligence Services, then broke away and started doing naughty things they shouldn't have done, and now we're going to have to stop them. But of course, if we come to the Syrian case, it's clear, I mean, there's evidence that British Special Forces and US Special Forces were training jihadis in Jordan who are now part of ISIS at this time last year. And there's definitely chatter that al-Baghdadi, who is supposedly the caliph of this new state, was in fact, Edward Snowden has said, that he was basically trained by Mossad. Now,
interesting, because surely you wouldn't think that the Israelis would be getting into
it's what he calls the hornet's nest strategy, which is that you don't forget that the real opposition to the Israelis' policies is coming from Hamas and Hezbollah. They are regarded as the main enemies, and they of course are genuine Islamist movements with military wings and political wing. But if you can set up a kind of loony as it were jihadi group which will undermine Assad, fight with Hezbollah, and basically spread Sunni Shia conflict, that's actually in line with the Yinon plan, which General Yinon, the Israeli general, put together in the 1980s. We're going to balkanize all the states around us
by fermenting an Islamic civil war.
By fermenting an Islamic civil war. Yeah, it's in the Yinon plan, which is public property.
Oh, very exciting. Now, I have a question. You may not be able to answer. In fact, I don't think I'll be able to answer it. How much traction do you think a freedom of information request from me to the Department of Defense would garner by asking how much of the ring-fenced, formerly Liam Fox, now Philip Hammond, defence budget is being diversified into these little side projects?
Well, I don't know whether you get very far, but I think there's quite a lot of evidence to show that it certainly has. I mean, British taxpayers' money certainly paid for weaponry that was used in Syria this time last year. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Okay, so we're not giving nurses pay rises so that we can keep making sure that we're fermenting little spats.
Well, also, the other thing that they do is they set up other fundraising techniques. So, for example, we mentioned the Contras in Nicaragua last week. They were funded. Their head, Adolfo Calero, was allowed to bring massive amounts of cocaine into the United States through MENA Air Base in Arkansas when Bill Clinton was the governor. And they were then allowed to, basically, they were given a nod and a wink, which allowed them to generate their own slush funds outside of defence budgets.
Exciting. Okay, so there's fingerprints all over this. Thank God for Edward Snowden. I never thought I'd hear myself say that. To bring us up to date with the Nigeria situation now. You say all the big noises from Boko Haram, what's left of Al-Qaeda and ISL, as they're now being called for some reason. They seem to change their name every week. They're in Saudi having a bit of a confab.
Yeah, they had a Hajj congress or a meeting is what I'm being told. And what I said to my source is, how are you going to document that? Because it's by its nature, it's a secret meeting. But if you think about it, it's not unlikely that the Saudis will be... I mean, the Saudis certainly were channeling money to Islamic State And to all of these other groups, and of course they are our allies. You know, Filton's.
Well, they're Filton's biggest customer, aren't they?
Well, exactly. So you know, it's not a sense of that. Oh, they're doing these things, but it's nothing to do with us. And I think what's actually happening, to be absolutely brutally honest, is they are fermenting. They're creating foxes, breeding foxes in the coverts, so that we can go fox hunting. There we are. We've bred up Islamic State to fight Assad. We couldn't get to war with Assad last year because the ordinary people just put up too much of an objection. But now we've got another proposition for you. We're going to go in and fight Islamic State because they're really nasty, even though last year they were the heroes. But anyway, the real purpose of all of this is to prevent an oil pipeline running from Iran through Syria to the Mediterranean coast. The Qataris want to run a different pipeline from where they are up to Turkey. So what ultimately determines these things is often either raw materials or pipelines and things of this sort.
You mean the football-loving nation of Qatar, who never ever paid anybody a bribe ever to get a major sporting event hosted in their country?
And the country where they've never had democratic elections, just like Saudi Arabia. And of course, if you don't have a democratic elections, as David Cameron's made absolutely clear, you just have to go. Like Assad, you've just got to go. Not tomorrow, not next week. But and if you don't go, then those who take up arms against you with car bombs and machine guns and mortars, they are the good guys.
Of course.
Because if you don't have an election, you've got no legitimacy.
Because they've got truth and God on their side.
Well, exactly. So all of those nations across the Middle East, including the Egyptian nation now, which has suppressed its democratic opposition, the British position, to be consistent, is that those who take up arms against these governments will be supported by us, as they were in Libya. The RAF will knock out their tanks. Come on. Time for an uprising.
Well, I'm interested to know, should I be checking under my car as I leave the studios this evening? This seems like a rather hot potato kind of info.
Well, I think what's happening is I suspect the ultimate source for this material is British intelligence. I'll be honest with you, and they want this out there, and that's why we're being allowed to run with it.
Exciting. You've dragged me into a web of intrigue, so I'm now
but
a
I don't
puppet
mean, the fact
of the
is,
British
the,
state.
The fact is, the point I would make is that this is all a lot more complicated than bad guys with bad jihadis and good Westerners and all the rest of it. The real complication is that they've been playing footsie with these people for years. Sometimes they do things that are out of their control, but a lot of what's going on is, in fact, manipulated. So, for example, the two beheadings we were talking about earlier, I mean, analysis in the mainstream press, in the Telegraph and the Times, have just come up and said, well, these beheading videos are just a joke. A, nobody's being beheaded in these videos, mm-hmm. And B, there's no evidence that ISIS produced them.
Yeah, but frankly, Martin, these might be the same analysts who told me that Dr. David Kelly committed suicide.
Well, Dr. David Kelly didn't commit suicide, as you're well aware, and that's what doctors have been saying. There was no coroner's inquest. There was a coroner's inquest on Berezovsky, who we mentioned last week, the uh-huh. Russian, and the coroner refused to sign it off as a suicide. But the coroner never even got to... What happened was that the Hutton inquiry meant that the coroner's inquest was cancelled. So there was no coroner's inquest completed.
Oh, very exciting.
But I mean, of course, you have to ask yourself a question. Why aren't we following normal procedure here?
Well, I'm also intrigued to know why the repatriations of British Armed Forces dead were moved to Royal Wootton Bassett from Bryce Norton. Well, was it anything to do with the Oxfordshire County Coroner claiming or declaiming that each one of the repatriated bodies was a murder victim because of the illegal war that Tony Blair had decided to wage?
It might have been something to do with the other thing that they moved to Wootton Bassett, away from Wootton Bassett, was that they just didn't want people, because there's so many people being killed in these foreign wars now, they didn't want it on the news every night, another body. The same thing's happened in the US. As the bodies come home, they are, you know, trucked out the back door back to their families without a load of fuss being made, because it's basically too many people dying.
Interesting. Right, we're going to hold a mirror up to all of this presently, because we're going to be talking about in some people's eyes the great Messiah, the Second Coming, one of the finest statesmen of the 20th century. In many other people's eyes, a polemicist, a despot and a nutcase. Ian Paisley shuffled off his mortal coil today. More on that after 6:30. Yes, he did. After 6:30, 88 years old. But we're talking democracy, and actually actually, we do have to rather celebrate the democratic success that is becoming manifest north of the border at the moment. There is an expectation there will be over 80% turnout in the Scottish independence referendum next Thursday. Surely we should be celebrating this.
I think we should. I think we should. And I know it's not the position of the Labour Party. If I was Scots, I would probably be voting yes. Because I'm English, I'm ambivalent about it, because it will then leave a kind of rump UK with a completely dysfunctional electoral system. And it will be like a massive six counties where it's virtually impossible for us to get people elected and take over the government.
Well, we'll get on to the six counties shortly. But your Labour have been your whole life. Labour have held sway in Scotland for decades. Why on earth do Scotland, who have always returned Labour to Westminster, want, need, feel the compulsion to step away from Great Britain?
Well, what's actually, if you actually look at the opinion polls, what's happening is that the Labour vote is switching to independence, which is the Labour leadership in Scotland and nationally are in a blue funk about this, because it potentially creates all kinds of problems for Ed Miliband at the general election in May next year.
But isn't it the Scottish heart, the Labour heartland of Scotland, finally realising that Labour has done nothing for them?
I think that's an element of that. What you've got, what's developed in Scotland with devolution, is that you've actually got an electoral system which is responsive to popular pressure. The first past the post system in Westminster, which was done away with in Northern Ireland, as you know, in the 70s, it's still in place down here. And it actually leads to a very, very distorted outcomes. So as a small number of swing voters in the commuter towns around London determine British general elections. Nobody else matters.
But this is the tenet of Magna Carta, one man, one vote.
Yes, but it depends on what the size of the constituencies are, and whether, and also proportional voting, as you know, has been the case in the Republic of Ireland since 1920.
Well, we inherited that from the British when they left the country in tatters as some kind of divide and rule tactic.
Yes, but I'm in favour of proportional representation because it allows new political forces to enter the lists.
But nothing ever gets done. There's never consensus. It's constant horse trading.
Well, yes, but on the other hand, as constant horse trading goes on in the first past the post system, but you just don't see it. You're just presented with the result. This is what we're doing. I mean, many Labour voters are not very happy with the rightward drift of the party. But if they vote against Labour, even for more left-wing parties, all they will do is allow the right in. So the first past the post system is like a game of cricket. You're either in or you're out. Whereas in actual fact, what for proportional representation, and in New Zealand, the left of the Labour Party forced proportional representation in the early 1980s because they felt trapped by the Westminster style system. And it actually means that the game is much faster and changes can happen much more quickly, and the politicians have to take account of people's feelings on an almost daily basis.
Okay, people's backs were put up enormously when the great caliphs deigned to leave their plush offices in Westminster and go north of the border on Monday.
Well, yes, I mean, Alex Salmond was just roaring with laughter.
Well, it was grist to the mill for him, wasn't it?
Yes, of course it was. I mean, especially with David Cameron turning up, saying, please don't vote for independence just to kick the effing Tories. But, I mean, that's putting ideas in people's heads, isn't it, really?
But, I mean, apart from a few of the wealthier enclaves of Scotland, Perthshire, for instance, quite a lot of Edinburgh, places like that, the Tory vote in Scotland it's not an appreciable vote.
No, it's not. But obviously, from a Labour point of view, if we lose those 40 or 50 Labour MPs, it's going to make it that much more difficult to turn out the current coalition in May 2015. If I was Scots, I would simply say that. I mean, as Michael Collins said to Churchill and Lloyd George, who was negotiating with him, and saying, look, we'd like to give you home rule, Michael, but you know, think about the consequences for India. And Collins just said, that's your problem.
Exactly. And this brings us on to the next phase. I don't want to leave Scotland yet, by the way, because this is very exciting.
No. Oh,
it's actually democracy working And it, at work.
It is. And look at the way all of these companies and, you know, the Royal Bank of Scotland and all these other people have lined up and say, if you do this, the sky will fall. Mortgage cases will rise. And of course, and Darling was saying, well, you know, if I'd not been a Chancellor of the British Exchequer, we couldn't have bailed out RBS. And of course, you can ask the question, should we have bailed out RBS?
Indeed, and well done.
Should we have bailed out RBS at all?
Well done. That's a question, isn't it? It was three Scots who managed to bankrupt the country in 10 years ago now.
There was Northern Rock as well. Don't forget, Leeds were responsible. And in actual fact, you'll find that it was all in Wall Street where all this started.
Yeah, which isn't a Labour heartland, but incidentally, the Labour heartland that did. Anyway, we're going to take some music because I got to take a call. This is the Stereo MC. Step it up to the polling stations.
Just what goes
Oh, yes. To the left, to the right. Which way are you going to vote? That's the Stereo MCs here on Bristol Community 93.2 FM. Again, a little bit of serendipity because I had to take a call from Mike Hackett, I beg your pardon, who is stuck in traffic around town. And he has reliably informed me, because I do trust his opinion, he spends a lot of time on the roads, town is a disaster. There is a major incident on the A38 at the Haymarket in the city centre on the James Barton roundabout. Ambulances, there was curtains up, there was police cars about an hour and a half ago. It's still ongoing. M32 is jammers. Coming over to the Redfield roundabout, St. J. The whole thing, very, very bad news. A4 inbound and outbound. So Bridge Valley Road between Portway between Bridge Valley Road and Sylvan Way. Very, very bad. If you want our advice, because Martin Summers and myself, Billy Quain, are here on the Friday Politics Show on Bristol Community 93.2 FM, go to the pub. Have yourself a fizzy water, or a glass of soda, or a pop, and a bag of crisps. Wait for about 45 minutes, and then you'll have a nice, stress-free get home. It's a shame, because it's a beautiful evening. Right, that's the traffic update. It's a disaster. Sorry about that, everyone. And I don't think the Metro bus is going to help it. Martin Summers, we're talking Scottish independence.
Yes, if that's what the opinion polls are suggesting may happen. And I think a high turnout, as everybody expects, because lots of people have registered to vote. I don't suppose lots of people have registered to vote no.
Well, apparently, a lot of people in their 30s and 40s and 50s. This is Alex Salmon talking to Eddie Mayer on Radio 4's PM show the other day. Have registered for the first time.
Yeah.
And there was an anecdote. Obviously, this is an Alex Salmon anecdote, so I'm not sure how much store you can set by it. Somebody had cast a postal no vote and had contacted the SNP to see how they can get the vote back so they can vote yes, because they had changed their mind when the three bigwigs turned up on Monday.
Yes, I mean, the three, you know, two of them privately educated, but all three of them very, very Southern English British leaders turned up. I don't think that did the no campaign any favours, actually.
Nigel Farage, or Farage, as he's actually should be pronounced, has decided to go north of the border. What do we think of this? Because a lot of, you know, political analysts are beginning to liken him somewhat to Thomas Paine, the plain-talking man of the people in the pub with common-sense solutions to democratic problems.
No, he went to private school and he used to work as a stockbroker. He's a renegade Tory in a pinstripe suit.
From Jersey.
Yeah. Yes, and of course, yes, he doesn't pay taxes in this country and all the rest of it, like they don't. I think that's one of the things that growth of kind of little Englandism, south of the Wash in particular, is very, very unacceptable in Scotland. I mean, Scotland sees itself as at the centre of European culture.
Frankly, it was 300 years ago.
It was indeed, yes. And they look across the sea to Norway, which is outside the EU, but Norway has had, until recently, Labour governments since World War II, and they've got the highest standard of living, the lowest level of inequality. They've got a huge sovereign wealth fund which will pay for old age care and nursery schools in Norway into the rest of this century. And the Scots looking across the North Sea at that, saying that could have been us.
But haven't the Scots missed the boat with this? Because Norway's wealth and security and stability has been built on this enormous fund of oil revenue that they banked from day one. There's 30 years left in most of the North Sea fields.
Well, what happened in Britain was that the Labour government was in power in 1979 when they discovered North Sea oil.
Okay, with Tony Benn, as I remember, as Minister for Energy.
And of course, the Norwegians, when at the same time they discovered it, they said, right, well, we don't know much about the oil industry, but we will learn. We will set up our own nationalised oil company, Statoil, and then we will begin to learn how to do it. So it took longer for the oil to come on stream. That didn't make much difference in Norway, because the Labour Party were likely to be running Norway at any time into the future. That's changed recently, but I don't want to go into that. But that meant that they could take their time and build their own oil industry, controlled by them, with their own currency, of course, as well, because they're outside the EU. And therefore, of course, they built up the sovereign wealth fund because they didn't want to get what they call the Dutch disease, where because you've got oil, your currency rises in value, and that actually chokes off your industrial exports. Mm-hmm. So what they did is they made a rule that none of the money was to be invested inside Norway. It's got to be invested outside Norway, and then we'll use the money to then pay for social services and so on inside Norway. So in other words, they made a long-term plan based on their socialist principles. What happened with the Labour government? The Labour government thought, if we can get this on stream quick by getting the American companies in there, then we will be able to get the taxation revenue from it, be able to bribe our supporters and win the general election. And of course, what happened was the American companies were allowed into the North Sea. Margaret Thatcher then inherited the government, and of course she then was able to cushion all of the viciously anti-ordinary people policies that she pushed through with North Sea oil revenue.
And of course privatised BP, which was an enormous success because it created Harry Enfield's loads of money.
Exactly. And the other thing, of course, if you remember the Piper Alpha disaster, in the oil industry in the British North Sea, trade unions were basically banned. If you were shown to have been carrying out trade union activity, you were not required back, NRB. And so trade unions, there was an oil industry liaison committee run by Ronnie McDonald, but they had to meet in secret, and when they spoke to the press, they had to wear masks and so on so that nobody could see who they were. In the Norwegian sector of the North Sea, it's a nationalised industry, everybody is in the union, and the union reps, for example, have the right to stop production immediately if they're unhappy with any safety issues.
Exciting.
Whereas what happened in the Piper Alpha disaster is the accommodation block was on the top of the wellhead, so when the wellhead blew, everybody in the accommodation block was incinerated. In the Norwegian sector of the North Sea, the accommodation block isn't on the same platform as the wellhead. So if I was a Scot looking across the North Sea to what had happened in Norway and compared to what had happened in Scotland, it might encourage me to think, hang on a minute, that could have been us, but it wasn't. Why wasn't it?
Is it too late for them?
I think it's too late to go back and do all of those things again, for obvious reasons. You can't. It's too late.
Okay, there's 30 years of relatively difficult to get at oil left in the North Sea.
Yeah, I don't think the case for Scottish independence is entirely based around the idea that we've got oil.
Well, no, there's £25 billion a year in whisky revenue as well.
Yes, but in any case, the idea that a country of that size can't manage its own affairs and will, you know, they're like children, you know, if they're children in a sweet shop, that is silly. I think whatever happens, things are never going to be the same, even if no vote wins. And if the yes vote wins, I wish Scotland every success in trying to build a fairer and more socially just society. One of the most telling things I've seen in the debate was when a middle-aged woman spoke to Alistair Darling and said, I hope next time you go to dinners with all of these US health companies which you wanted to bring into the National Health Service, I hope Aneurin Bevan was on your shoulder. And of course New Labour did open the health service to privatisation and foreign bids and all the rest of it. And that went down well enough in the swing constituencies around London, where nobody thinks about these things too much because they've all got the same, you know, everything's got to revolve around their pea brains. In Scotland, people were disgusted. That was betrayal. And the SNP have been able to clean up on the back of that.
And, of course, they introduced tuition fees.
Indeed, but not in Scotland.
No, the Scots wouldn't stand for it.
Well, exactly. And you can see that the Scots have got a different way of approaching social issues, certainly than Nigel Farage and others like him.
Can we learn a lesson south of the border from them?
Yes. I think if the Scots do go their own way, we will have to reform the English and Welsh and Northern Irish, because it'll still all be one thing. We'll have to reform the system. I mean, in Wales and Northern Ireland, for obvious reasons, we've changed the electoral system in those countries because that's been the will of the people. And in England, we'll have to change. If we change the electoral system, it'll be a different ball game. They did this in New Zealand in the early 80s.
Yeah, we mentioned this. Yeah,
they had a Labour government, and the Labour government had been captured by basically pro-US, pro-business interests. Roger Douglas, their finance minister, one of the first things he did was privatise the railway. And of course, in New Zealand, they'd voted Labour because they've got a very strong Labour tradition in New Zealand going back to the 30s, because they didn't want Thatcherism and all the rest of it. And of course, the activists in the unions and the activists in the Labour Party immediately realised that they were going to vote Labour, but they were going to get the same policy as Thatcher was imposing in Britain. But it's only a small country, New Zealand, so they said, right, you know what we're going to do? We're going to knock on every door in New Zealand, we're going to demand a referendum on PR. And that's what they did. And they've soon had more than half the population signed up for it. They forced it through. The Labour Party split. The unions took their money with what was called New Labour. The old rump Labour Party stood against the New Labour Party under a PR setup. They didn't get anybody elected at all. So the sort of Blairite types in New Zealand were evicted from mainstream politics.
So there's lessons to be learned.
There is, but I mean, you've got to have a viable system. I mean, you know, we're talking about games. They were revolutionising rugby union at the same time. You know, when I first started to play your rugby union in the 70s, you could kick for touch from anywhere.
Yeah.
Which, of course, meant that the game is constantly stopping.
Yes, and you weren't allowed to lift in the line out either. That's the most important thing.
No.
Right, we're going to move away from that now, actually. Yeah. Final, before we leave Scotland alone, I'm very excited. I'm excited to see democracy in practice and how one of the cornerstones of the free Western world, the Westminster Houses of Parliament, react to a democratic decision taken by the Demos north of the border. That will be interesting.
It will be interesting. It's certainly stirred things up. And if I was Scots, I'd be voting yes. But it's going to leave people south of the border with progressive politics with a bit of a headache if they do.
Worse than that, it's going to leave people west of the Mull of Kintyre, because there has been unrest, frankly, for 400 years in and around the six counties of Northern Ireland to do with Westminster government by... not by rote, but government, indirect government, absentee landlordism. This is going back into the mist of time to the flight of the Earls and what have you. But Edward Carson came along in the 1910s, set up the Ulster Volunteer Force to defend the planted Protestant population against potential Catholic incursions and Dublinite sentiment. Actually, it wasn't Dublinite really at all. It was Connacht and further south in the country, because Dublin had a very staunchly Protestant educated elite population anyway, as it still does, hence beyond the pale being an expression, because the pale was the ancient barrier around the city of Dublin. If Scotland votes yes for independence, obviously that's going to be the next thing on the agenda. Independence for Northern Ireland.
Well,
not devolved powers, independence.
No, not for Northern Ireland. The Sinn Féin are calling, if there is a vote yes in Scotland, for another vote in the six counties for reunification of Ireland.
Which is a vote for independence.
Yes, well, you could, yeah, but of course the loyalist Protestant community would say that they have given up on the idea of an independent Northern Ireland, because that's what got them into trouble in the first place.
Well, they never wanted an independent Northern Ireland. You know, Ulster Unionists want to be governed by the Queen from Westminster.
Well, that's true in one way and not true in another. I mean, I think one of the things we mentioned, that Ian Paisley died today.
He did.
One of the first things he said when he finally met with Martin McGuinness, because there was all this fuss, are we going to meet with him? Are they going to shake hands? All of this stuff. And it finally, because Trimble had fallen over the whole thing, Trimble had refused to shake hands with him, so there's all that kind of grandstanding going on. And when Paisley went into the room where McGuinness was, he strode across the room, he's a big fella, grabbed McGuinness by the hand and said, Martin, we can govern ourselves. So in other words, he was...
The DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party line, not the Ulster Unionist Party, the Democratic Unionist Party line, when Paisley finally came to his senses, he could have done that 45 years earlier and saved an awful lot of bloodshed, many would argue. His vision for Northern Ireland was self-government from Stormont, independent of the UK.
Not independent of the UK, but as you know, the Good Friday Agreement had to have a vote in the Republic and in the six counties to bed it in. And the Republic gave up its territorial claim to the north by that vote. But at the same time, it's not just... There's power sharing built into it. Yeah, there's a bit like the constitution in Lebanon before the civil war there. You know, the first minister has to be from the majority community, but the second minister has to be from the minority community.
Mm-hmm.
And these kind of what sound like Byzantine stitch-ups are actually the glory of the British system, if you like. It's a bit of a mess in lots of different ways. There's no proper written constitution. The electoral system's a farce. But we do bodge along. And we'll bodge along. If Scotland votes yes, we'll bodge along. It'll just be another change that's taken place.
I'm pleased you mentioned the Byzantine model, because essentially Northern Ireland, for the last 15 years, certainly since the Good Friday Agreement, has been governed along sectarian lines. However much they're not blowing each other up or kneecapping one another anymore, although there's a whole bunch of that still going on, it's Protestant is still Red Hand of Ulster. We require a queen, and we require to fly the Union flag over all of our public buildings every day of the year.
Yes.
And the Republican side, the nationalist side, are inherently Catholic.
Well, not all of them. And historically, of course, the Republican movement was founded by Belfast Protestants, Wolfe Tone, Robert Emmet, and so on.
Well,
so,
they were the ones with the education and the oratory
skills.
Indeed,
I mean, that doesn't make cut a lot of ice in modern Ireland, but it is an interesting quirk of history. The point is that as John Hume said about the agreement, it's a hologram. Everybody can see in it what they want to see in it.
Mm-hmm.
So for the Republicans, the door to a united Ireland has not been closed. It's still open for a future generation to step through that door. That's not ruled out. For the Loyalists, they've got a guarantee that they're not going to be forced to step through that door if they don't want to step through it. Now, that's not a perfect solution from anybody's point of view. But on the other hand, it's a better solution than killing each other about arguing about it.
Per head of population, Northern Ireland is costing the UK government twice as much as any other part of their dominion, including Gibraltar and the Falklands.
Well, it used to be called the Keynesian Republic of Northern Ireland. So even during the Thatcher era, you remember they introduced the poll tax in Scotland because they thought, well, the Scots won't like it, but if we can ram it through there, then we'll be able to ram it through in England. They didn't introduce the poll tax in Northern Ireland. It would have been an absolutely disaster.
I think they had enough to be getting on.
They had enough to be getting on with. And of course, the point is that they've still got the rates in Northern Ireland. So you still have property taxes paying for local government, unlike the ridiculous community charge which we have in Bristol, which is levied on individuals, not on property. It's relatively regressive, so the top levels don't pay as much as people on low incomes, and that, in other words, it's poll tax mark two.
Yes.
But they haven't got poll tax mark two in Northern Ireland. They still have relatively well funded local government on the rates. Because there was no way that you were going to force through that kind of neoliberal reform in a situation like that. And also, what was very interesting a few years ago when the new coalition came to power, the heads of all the devolved governments in Britain, in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, the prime ministers and deputy prime ministers, all signed a letter saying that the government's cuts policy was wrong. But that included Peter Robinson. So in other words, the Loyalists were actually lining up with the SNP, with Labour, with Plaid Cymru, to oppose Conservative policy. And I think that's the difference between the DUP
Hang on a second. You're trotting out Labour trope at me at the moment. Yeah. My point to you is, I'm not certain the majority of UK taxpayers, British taxpayers, are aware that the Northern Irish population, the entirety of the six counties population, whichever side of the sectarian divide they stand on, are costing them twice as much as any other member of society who carries a British passport.
Well, they were aware of it, and this is what the Ulster Unionists brought them to Democratic Unionists brought them to the negotiating table in the end. Because in actual fact, if you'd had a referendum in Britain, do we want to keep Northern Ireland, the majority would have voted no. So so in a sense, the Republicans were pushing at an open door there, which is what the IRA was saying. Well, if we hit them hard enough and keep hitting them hard enough, they don't want to be here. They want to get out of here. They'll bottle it. And of course, the British Army took the same similar view towards the Republicans. These paddies, if we just hit them hard enough, they'll bottle it as well. And in actual fact, what actually happened, after a lot of suffering on all sides, was that nobody bottled it. The IRA didn't bottle it. The British Army didn't bottle it. And at that point... At that point, finally, some kind of discussion was got. And I'm afraid that is the way that wars are fought. We've seen the same thing happening in Ukraine. There was only a ceasefire last week because the Ukrainian government forces, who have got paramilitary units fighting with them, a bit like the UVF and the UDA, but they were getting thrashed. And at that point, they decided they want a ceasefire. And only then.
Interesting. It will happen. I can't see it not happening. If Scotland votes for independence... there will have to be some kind of referendum in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, well, I think the unionists are reasonably calm about that because they think that they will win such a referendum. And the most opinion polls show that the population change... I mean, I saw Gary McMichael from the UDA speaking at a meeting in London at the TUC years ago. And it was quite strange, actually, because he was there with what's his name... PUP guy with the pipe.
No idea.
It doesn't matter. He used to head the UVF. Doesn't matter. But anyway, Gary McMichael was there. And he said, and there are lots and lots of Republicans in the room. And they asked him a question. Said, you know, there's going to be a Catholic nationalist majority in the six counties within, you know, some time scale.
Well, I think it exists now.
Well, it's west of the band, certainly. And he said, so what's your answer to that? And he said, well, it's very good you asked me that question, because we perceive that as well. And we know that that will happen, whether it's in 5 years' time or 50 years' time. And that's why the UDA is supporting this peace agreement. Because when that day comes where we're the minority instead of the majority, we want the same decent treatment as we're offering you today, and that's why we support this peace agreement. And I'm glad to say that he got a standing ovation from all the Republicans in the room. And at that point, I was very pleased to see that, because everybody, the horror of what's gone on has been pretty bad, but everybody, when people go on about Northern Irish politicians being political pygmies and all the rest of it, I think that's just wrong. They're actually much higher quality, because it's a school of hard knocks over there, whatever side you're coming from.
Well, after fashion, and this brings me on to what I'm going to ask you next, because you have been a political animal for decades now. There's no doubt about that. You're informed. You have your own set of beliefs and values, but you can't not have been aware of Ian Paisley and his impact and his presence. Many would argue, myself amongst them, that he was a polemicist and caused more problems than he ever created solutions for. But I would like to garner your thoughts on him by way of an obituary.
Well, I agree with you that he used to rally the most recidivist elements within his own community for many years. So anybody like Terence O'Neill or even Trimble, who was attempting to try and compromise, Paisley would be breathing down their neck and breaking their legs. But that was the same was true on the Republican side. There were various attempts to get the SDLP into power-sharing administrations, and the Republicans weren't happy with that.
They weren't fighting that fight from behind a collar.
No, they weren't. But, I mean, don't forget that Ian Paisley's collar, you may not know this, he became Dr. Ian Paisley because he sent $15 to Bob Jones University in Texas, which is also the alma mater of George Bush Jr.
He did study theology in Carmarthenshire as well.
All right. But, I mean, the point is he set up his own church before he set up his own political party. But, I mean, the point is he's a larger-than-life figure. And I think what was very interesting in the final negotiations between him and what it was basically came down to negotiations between him and the Republicans, that everybody else is there to be, you know, brought on side by those two forces. And there was elections coming up in Dublin and elections coming up in London, and they wanted a quick agreement for the politicians in Dublin and London wanted a quick agreement to suit their purposes. And what Paisley said to Adams and McGuinness was, look, we're not doing it to their timetable. It's our deal, not their deal. So we're not going to do it to suit people in Dublin, and we're not going to do it to suit people in Dublin. I'm going to hang tough. And I suggest that you go back to your community and hang tough. But we will do a deal on our timetable. And I think that was a stroke of genius by Paisley. and the Republicans could buy into that and say, right, that's right, we'll all hang tough, we're not signing. And then that created panic both in London and Dublin that it wasn't going to come off. But Paisley promised privately to the Republicans, I will sign in the September, I will. And what the Republicans said to me, we don't have to sign in September, we can string this out as long as you like. We've waited 800 years, we can wait 8 months, 8 years, or whatever. No, he said, no, my word is my bond, we will do this deal in September, but not on their timetable, on our timetable.
You're almost making him sound like an honourable person.
In the end, you can admire somebody's political skill, even if you don't agree with a word they say. He was a very skillful political operator because if, for example, he had signed a deal which more extreme elements in his community wouldn't buy into, the same would be true for Adams and McGuinness. They've got to keep the IRA together as they're doing this deal. If they compromise too much, the IRA is going to split.
Well, they didn't do particularly well at keeping the IRA together, let's be honest, because IRA, there's the Reform IRA.
Well, I know, but I mean, they're nothing like as organised as the Provost used to be. And of course, the same is true on the Loyalist side. You've got people who regard Paisley as a sellout, and you've got these silly lads running around breaking shop windows because people won't fly the Union flag every day of the year over the town hall. I mean, that sort of stuff is... You know, it's just childish beyond belief.
Well, it's idiotic. Can we say democracy is working in Northern Ireland? Really? Because democracy does rely on an informed electorate.
Well, I would say that all of these people that I've met from both sides over the years are far more informed. I mean, I remember going into a bar in West Belfast a few years ago, and they're all reading proper newspapers. You know, Anderson's Town News has got international coverage. And it's got lots of articles with real information about Nigeria in. And I'm saying, that's not the flipping Sun, is it? He said, no, we don't read that nonsense here. Yeah? Uh-huh. And these people are not graduates or whatever. They're all painters and decorators and whatever, but they read decent newspapers. And I think the idea that the political leadership in Northern Ireland and the people of Northern Ireland are some, you know, backward, and that you know, they've gradually come round to be modernised, you'll find that the level of political consciousness... Particularly on the Republican side, but also on the Loyalist side, is far higher than you're going to find in the average pub in Surrey. Far higher.
Exciting. Well, our time is nearly up, Martin. Have we got any more business that we need to take care of? Anything that we need to touch base on before I get out of Tony Gosling's chair?
Briefly say stuff about the Ukraine, because we mentioned that earlier. I mean, the ceasefire last Friday was potentially very important, because what happened was Poroshenko went to meet with Putin and the rebels in Minsk on Friday morning. Then he flew to Wales Friday afternoon. And the NATO people were all gearing up for further conflict. You know, a spearhead led by the British paratroops is going to go and sort it all out, etc. And Poroshenko had to tell them, no, we're having a ceasefire. The reason they are having the ceasefire is because they were basically being beaten on the ground in East Ukraine by the rebels. But on the other hand, ceasefires are good. I've always been in favour of ceasefires. Ceasefires mean that people take a step back and have a think about what comes next. Doesn't mean the ceasefire is going to stick. It doesn't mean that's the end of the road. It doesn't mean that you're going to necessarily get what you want. But it starts to. It means that everybody has a legitimate. You know, there's going to be some kind of legitimising political discussion, because the real problem in Ukraine from the very get-go is this idea that we can crush these people in the East Ukraine who voted for independence. It's like as if Scotland voted for independence and we just sent the tanks in. Yeah. It wouldn't work.
Well, it may still happen. Careful what you wish for.
Well, what may happen is an independent Scottish government finds all sorts of obstacles placed in its way.
You think?
Yeah, I think. They may find that that all sorts of people start to make, especially with the removal of Trident and so on. Mm-hmm. This is international politics, which will cause, you know, big boys to get annoyed.
Excellent. Very good. That's it for our time. Thank you very much for having me for the last fortnight. Have I passed the test?
You have. You're livelier than Tony, but... but that's good.
Good. It's been a real pleasure sitting in for Tony Gosling, who will be back next week here on Friday Politics on Bristol Community 93.2 FM. Martin Summers, have you got anything that's a burning issue for next week's topic of discussion that we can give a reveal?
Well, no doubt I'll be hearing more about what's been going on in Nigeria and in Saudi Arabia from my secret contacts.
Yes, very good. We look forward to that. Do stay tuned here on Bristol Community 93.2 FM, because next up we've got Mohammed Makawi with Leila Arabia taking you through until 8 p.m. That's it for me. Have a great weekend. I'm back at 10 tomorrow. Tune in. We're talking Irish independence, Juno and the Paycock style.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. A seven-year-old girl who's believed to have been shot in the head by her father has died in hospital. Mary Shipstone's been in a serious condition since a shooting in the village of Northiam in East Sussex yesterday. The girl's father was found dead after apparently killing himself. Oscar Pistorius will be sentenced next month after being found guilty of culpable homicide. Yesterday, he was cleared of planning to murder his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, always claiming he'd mistaken her for an intruder. But the judge said he had been irresponsible.
The accused acted negligently when he fired shots into the toilet door, knowing that there was someone behind the door and that there was very little room in which to manoeuvre.
Police have launched a criminal investigation over the deaths of two babies who may have been given contaminated feed in hospital drips. They both died in June at Guy's and St Thomas's in London. Northern Ireland's former First Minister, Dr Ian Paisley, has died after a long illness at the age of 88. He vowed never to work with Sinn Féin, but ended up leading a power-sharing administration at Stormont. He and Deputy First Minister Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness got on so well, they were nicknamed the Chuckle Brothers.
He treated me with only respect and friendship, and I similarly made huge efforts also to ensure that we...